Hello, everyone, and welcome to Police Off the Cuff, Real Crime Stories. I'm your host, retired NYPD Sergeant Bill Cannon, a 27-year veteran of the NYPD. You know, this case, I think, gets a little stranger and stranger as we move along, and perhaps it's partially due to the fact that the information has just been slowly pouring out, not even pouring out, seeping out, I should say, right? And I'm going to put the thumbnail on the screen. And this is what concerns me. And I think that this investigation is not by any means close to being over. And what do I mean by that? Well, what I mean by that is that there could be others involved in this that we don't know. And at first I poo-pooed and I sort of dismissed the God's Misfits connection. And no longer am I doing that, because certain things about this case, and of course, the biggest thing about this case is that two innocent women, Veronica Butler and Jillian Kelly, lost their lives over a custody battle that you would have thought would have involved the grandmother, who was Tiffany Adams. How did all these other people get involved in this? And how did they all destroy their lives? Yes, destroy their lives over this by taking the lives of these two women. It is so, so baffling to me. So we're going to discuss tonight the cultish sort of background of God's Misfits. And I'm not saying, you know, a gentleman has gone on saying he was the founder and all this. I don't think they're aligned with that organization of God's Misfits. I think they started their own. And they're anti-government. And we'll read a little bit about Paul Grice's. You know, you hear about all this sovereign citizen stuff. It's pretty damn scary. But the bottom line here is that right now, but five people involved in this murder in the first degree, kidnapping in the first degree, conspiracy to commit murder. Five people besides, of course, the obvious, these two women that were murdered, that lost their lives over a custody dispute. Why did five people destroy their lives to murder these two women? Why did they do that? It makes absolutely no sense to me, and nor should it to you. But we're going to try to make a little bit more sense of it tonight. So hold on to your hats. You're about to enter true crime from a police perspective. You're about to enter the off-the-cuff zone, the police off-the-cuff zone.
There has to be some common sense.
Yes, sir. They have the car stopped in Tampa Ranch, Michael Byder.
We still don't know who pulled the trigger.
Joining me tonight to discuss this complicated, horrific murder and lives, how many lives total have been ruined by this? I don't even think we can count them, but many lives have been destroyed. The lives of the children, the lives of the spouse in this, the children, just unbelievable. So joining me tonight to discuss this, I had to pick someone who's got a really good brain. Retired NYPD sergeant, professor at Albertus Magnus College in Connecticut, attorney Mike Geary. Welcome to the show, Mike.
Good evening, Bill. Thank you for having me on. Good evening, everyone. Welcome.
It's my pleasure, because I just don't think I could dissect this myself tonight because, Mike, when this first occurred, I sort of, when I heard about this God's misfits, I sort of like poo-pooed it. Oh, I don't think that has anything to do with it. And now I'm not so sure because at the very least, these people, these conspirators, let's look at them right there. There's five of them on the screen there. These conspirators got together and they devised a scheme. They sat down, they met together at least once a week. So how and why were they getting together as God's misfits? And was this planning always going on? There you have it. Tiffany Adams, Tad Cullum, Cole Twombly, Cora Twombly. Now, in any group like this, there's a leader. And unfortunately, I think the leader in this group is the loosest cannon of all of them. And it's going to be Granny there to the left on the screen with Cora Twombly. But then I also asked, it opens up a Pandora's box of questions. How did Granny get these people to do her bidding? How did she get them to kill the mother of her grandchildren? And in doing so, killed an innocent woman, Jillian Kelly, who you see on the screen next to her. How did she get them to do it? Was it these weekly meetings of God's misfits? Did they all think the same way? Are they mind controlled? Are they brain controlled? I'm really thinking about this, Mike, because it doesn't make any sense otherwise. So did they all think this anti-government way, this sovereign citizen way? And did they think that had anything to do with going against the courts? Because the court maybe was about to give Veronica Butler custody, or at least more rights in custody? So is this how in their twisted minds, God's misfits was going to go rogue and go more than anti-government? They're going to murder somebody. And they were planning this. This obviously, and I'm not going to act like this was military precision, but there was a plan here, Mike. There was a plan to kill these people. And they set up the plan. And we don't know all the ugliness of this plan, but we're going to get to that. Mike, your thoughts? I've been talking for too long.
No, Bill, when we first heard about this case, and you know, you're concentrating on the investigation and the horror that the two innocent ladies must have undergone, and we were all talking about that, and you know, where the bodies were and things like that, and you know, you hear about the term God misfits after a couple of days, and you're like, okay, what could that possibly be? And then you find out that, you know, they're in rural Oklahoma, and they have this, you know, organization, maybe some sort of religious fervor. And then there's a gentleman in South Carolina who said he's a member of God's Misfits, and he totally disavowed any sort of knowledge or any connection between his group of God's Misfits in South Carolina to the people in Oklahoma. So they may not actually have ever been connected. It might be just by coincidence that they came up with a name like that. But yeah, they're, you know, it seems strange because this is a gang. It is a coordinated criminal enterprise that did not happen in the heat of a moment in terms of some sort of violent rage over an incident with a child. Some sort of really quick thing. No, this was planned, thought out. They had tried several times to kill her in the past. We know that because some of the people in the organization have made statements. But what is fascinating is, and you and I have talked about this, is, you know, who has the emotional, you know, wherewithal to want to have someone killed? And I see one person, Ms. Adams, and maybe her lover, Bert, whatever, strange husband, whatever you want to call him. But then you see the Twombleys there, and now we have Grice. So you go from one person who may have a real connection, an emotional connection, want this done, to then two, and now you're up to like five. That begs the question, you know, what kind of group was this really? Were they just, was it a religious group? Was there some sort of sprinkling of religion and anti-nationalism against our country? You know, was it almost like a militia, you know, with heavily armed? You know, and the more you delve into it, the more you start to wonder what kind of shape this group had. She seemed to be the leader, but it, you know, what we really need, I think, is to have someone from the inside, maybe Grice or the Twombleys, talk so that we know what were the internal dynamics of this group that would propel it over the course of many months to try and kill a beautiful girl over who's fighting over custody of her child with the grandmother. It is actually amazing. And hopefully we'll get more knowledge about the inner workings of this group, because every team, every gang, every group, every cohort, if they're together a while, it takes on a dynamic of its own. And who might the leader be? My guess, it is Ms. Adams, that she somehow figured out a way to get, you know, three other people involved in her machinations. Very scary. Very, very scary. Bill, I don't hear any sound. For anyone watching, I think we might have lost Bill right now. This happened once.
Oh, okay. You got me now. You got me
gotcha.
Now.
Okay, good.
It was gotcha. My fault. I was off the screen. I was trying to show his Twitter. And on the Twitter, I just knocked it off the screen. But it's basically him talking about being a sovereign citizen.
Oh, yeah.
A government. He's this, he's that. And that's scary, because is that also God's misfits? Is that who they are? Are they this anti-government group? And then we talk about right now, there's five of them that have been arrested. Are there more? Are there more? And there we have the five. Did the anti-government group God's misfits facilitate the murders of the Kansas moms? Well, I think the answer to that is yes. I think they did. And Paul Grice confessed. We know that. And we also know that Tiffany Adams confessed. And all the TV stations are arguing, was it really a confession? Or was it this? Was it that? It was a confession. Now, we don't know exactly what questions were asked by the investigators, but it was said that she confessed. But then they said that Paul Grice gave even a better confession. And he was more in depth with the things he said during his confession. So I want to try to put this up on the screen now, if I may. This is the affidavit. Here we go. So we see it at the bottom here again. Maybe I can make it a little bit bigger. There we go. Grice is the OSBI learned that Grice, Cullum, and Adams had cellular phone conversations amongst each other on March 30th, 2024, in the morning hours prior to the disappearance of Butler and Kelly. Grice and Cullum were together at Grice's home after the disappearance after 1,100 hours on the same day. So this is, let me just get back to that previous page. This, hang on a second. So OSBI investigation showed that Adams had searched for gun shops on a cellular phone. A search of local gun shops, Adams buying 5 stun guns at the Big R store in Guymon, Oklahoma. The purchase was made on March 23rd. On April 13th, 2024, a search warrant was executed at Beasley's property and an excavation of a possible burial site was commenced. I just want to mention those stun guns. Mm-hmm. Because we don't know right now the cause of death. And apparently the previous information that they were shot turned out not to be true. In fact, that's what News Nation was reporting, but they also reported early on that it was gunshot wounds. But apparently they got the medical examiner to at least say, no, they weren't shot. So what does that leave? Well, the thing it leaves is the scary thought that they were beaten to death. Blunt trauma, based on the fact that there was a hammer on the scene. And then with these stun guns, they could have controlled them in that way till they perhaps brought them to the gravesite. So all of these conjecturisms that we're making are really scary and ugly. But one other thing it shows is all this we spoke about is the premeditation and the planning, the almost precision planning. They were planning this thing, and what each person would do was decided in these meetings. And to me, that is quite scary, Mike.
Billy, that's malice aforethought. And what they say that distinguishes murder from any other kind of homicide, it's that planning, that motivation, the buying all the items that you need, getting ready, getting excuses. In this case, it's the cell phones, the burner phones, it's the stun guns. It's making sure that the property where they're going to bury the bodies is already prepared, you know, maybe a hole dug for them, having the Twombleys have a truck kind of park it across the road that they know that that Kelly's going to be driving down with Butler, you know. And so they have, as you say, everybody has their part. Everybody's in different locations and they're going to execute this plan. That is, and for all people, for all of them involved, that is malice aforethought. It is not any kind of emotional reaction to a sudden outrage, like, for instance, an attack upon them. No, this is cold-hearted planning. I mean, we kind of made a light of the fact that they had this idiotic plan with an anvil, and we thought that sounds a little ridiculous, and it does. But it just shows you the extent to which the plans that they had made to try and kill Kelly and Butler. And that is really scary. That's malice aforethought. There's really no room there for saying, oh, there was some sort of sudden, loss of control of emotion. No, this is absolute cold-blooded. This went on, when you look at the stun guns, this went on for several weeks. Just as buying the stun guns and cell phones, that shows at least a week preparation, 7 days preparation. Really scary that this went on and that everyone started, because it was all of those cell phones. It wasn't like they bought 2 cell phone burner phones. Everybody has a cell phone. So right from the get-go, there was already a group. It wasn't like there was one and they got 1 or 2 extra that came in at the last minute. No, you had a cohesive gang group working together, figuring it all out, like 7 days before the homicides occur. And that's what makes it so scary, that you could get all of these people to agree to do this ahead of time, knowing full well what the end result was going to be.
You know, Mike, this is almost like, to me, a military operation.
Yeah.
Loosely, planned over weeks. Mm-hmm. And each person had their job, right down to all of the details and to all the equipment they needed and what each person was done. I want to address David Ray in the chat. I knew you would come around. You see, I know this area, and today I see that law enforcement over in Tulsa are well aware of this group, cult, and its activity in more than just those two counties. You know, David Ray, I think that, as I said earlier on, I poo-pooed this group as not important. But now I'm thinking it's more important because I believe that as a group and God's misfits, let's call them what they referred to themselves as, they planned and they executed this horrific double murder kidnapping all over one person's, in New York, we'd call it a beef with her. Well, we could call her daughter-in-law. She wasn't actually a daughter-in-law, but she was the mother of the two children that Tiffany Adams was taking care of. Folks, this is Police Off the Cuff, Real Crime Stories. If you like real crime, true crime, from a police perspective, then you're in the right location. If you're not subscribed to us, go on our YouTube, hit that subscribe button, give us a thumbs up, ring that bell, hit the like button, share us with your friends and your family. And if you want to contribute to us, we have a Patreon with three different levels. We also have a YouTube channel membership with count five different levels, and you could support us through a YouTube channel membership. Yeah, I mean, Mike, what I fear in this case, I fear that there's going to be more arrests. I'm just feeling that right now. At first, I didn't, but now I'm starting to think that this could be a bigger group of more involved than we had first thought. And when they queried the police, when they queried the FBI had never heard about this group before, God's Misfits. And there was a guy on News Nation, and Nancy Grace, he called himself Squirrel. And he was allegedly the president. He said had no knowledge of these folks.
Right.
So is this a loose outlier of that initial group? Let me play a little bit of News Nation with Banfield right now.
Far, far more clear with Paul Grice. Police say his confession, it is black and white. And it lines up with all the details that the Twombleys' 16-year-old daughter told investigators weeks ago about the planning, about the murders, about the burial. She said Grice was a part of everything, start to finish. According to a friend of Paul Grice's, Paul was initially detained and questioned by investigators weeks and weeks ago. But for some reason, they let him go. And then recently we learned this about his anti-government views. Almost exactly 1 year ago, he filed this crazy 44-page document that reads like a Kaczynski manifesto against the USA, renouncing his US citizenship. But no matter what he believes, U.S. laws apply to Mr. Paul Grice, especially when it comes to murder. The sheriff tells us he's going to be arraigned a week from today, 9 a.m. So mark your calendar. News Nation's senior national correspondent Brian Enten is back with me now. So talk to me about this confession, because we heard about Grandma Tiffany's confession. It sounded more like we weren't sure. It was she indicated her responsibility. This is entirely different.
Yeah, this was much, much clearer, Ashley. We know that investigators were out at Paul Grice's house yesterday, and he lives not very far from where the bodies were discovered, by the way. He rents a property right in that area. They went out to talk to him yesterday. What led them to actually go out again to talk to him, we don't know, but there was this confession, and I want to read it to you because it was much, much more specific and clear than what we saw with the recorded statement from Grandma Tiffany. The confession reads, according to the affidavit, Grice was interviewed and admitted that he was a part of the planning and killing of both Butler and Kelly. Grice admitted that he participated in the killing of Butler and Kelly and their subsequent burial. So they are saying that not only was he connected to the planning, to the actual killing, but then also the burial. And you remember,
you know, Mike, I find this scary too, because they had everything planned right up until you know, the attack, they probably kept them under control and not killed them at the site with the stun guns. And then they brought them to the burial site. Was the burial site also the murder site? That's the some of the questions that I have. Let's not forget they buried them 10 feet deep, covered them with concrete, and then with hay, so that when they covered up the graves, cows would trample over and eat the hay, and you wouldn't see that the land was disturbed. So all of these details were thought of.
Billy, as you mentioned, it was a well-planned operation. And as I'm thinking, as we're looking at Brian Hinton and you're talking, I'm thinking, okay, you have five people all conspired over the course of months, actually, because they wanted to kill her months ago. Is it possible that there may be some other unexplained disappearances where that may be related to anyone in this group? Because after all, if Mr. Bryce and the Twobleys are willing to help out, you know, Ms. Tiffany Adams to kill daughter-in-law for the possession of her grandchildren, is it possible there's anybody else that may have been, you know, killed in the past or disappeared in the past? Because if you're willing to do this, was this a one-off operation, or has there ever been anyone else, say in the past couple of years, that may have suddenly disappeared from the area? So if I was the police, if I was the Oklahoma State Bureau of Investigation, I'd want to go through all the surrounding counties and see if they've got any sort of records of unusual disappearances, unexplained disappearances, and to see if there's any thought that maybe this group may have been responsible for other capital murders in this area, because I don't think this is a one-off. And because they did seem kind of well planned. So if they had that ability, maybe they've done this in the past. And I hope not, but I think as a cop, I got to be cynical and think that maybe there actually is a few other cases out there.
You know, Mike, the other thing is that allegedly Tiffany Adams and Tad Cullum they're quite affluent. Even the word rich has been used, that they have lots of money. Cole Twombly, he's offered to pay for his own attorney. The only one so far that has requested legal aid is Cora Twombly.
Right.
So that is a little bit scary too. There are people, it seems like some of the people, if there's anyone in the chat that's from this area, it seems like many people that lived in this area were afraid of these people, were terrified of these people. If anyone's in the chat that would like to confirm that's from this area, I would love to hear that. Dr. D, what makes me wonder is how much this evidence this Grice talked about on his phone after he was released. You know, Dr. D, the only thing I could, the News Nation, a lot of the TV stations make a big deal out of it, like, why did they let him go? Well, perhaps, as we say in law enforcement, they didn't have probable cause. So an arrest without probable cause against him is an illegal arrest. So they wanted to have more evidence. Once they got more evidence, he was invited back in. That's the bad word, probably. He was brought back in, and he was arrested and charged with all of the same charges that the other four were charged with. Mike, your thoughts?
Yeah, Bill, there, you know, as we've seen in the Koberger case and the Heurman case, so a lot of the new technology, like cell phone technology, geofencing, and things like that, are so now vitally important to figuring out where people were at times, who they were with, and you put that all together, and it helps you build a case and help you get to probable cause. I'm thinking that they had a lot of information first on the grandmother and Cole and the Twobleys, and then they were just maybe waiting for a little bit more confirmation information on you know, this fifth guy, and they didn't have it at the time. They want to talk to him. You want to talk to him quickly while everything's fresh. But I'm thinking they just were missing a little bit of information. They knew, you know, they probably knew that he was absolutely part and parcel of this conspiracy, you know, joining in on them, but they just were just missing something, maybe just a little bit of information. I'm thinking it was probably cell phone information. And I think once they got it, that just kind of sealed the deal for him. But I don't think there's anything wrong with, you know, making an arrest. You don't want to jump the gun. You know, you don't want to do that. You want to, if he's not, especially if he's not a flight risk or anything like that, and maybe you have someone watching his home or that sort of thing, they did the right thing. Better to wait a little bit, make sure you got all your ducks in order, and then move in on them.
You know, Mike, we used to joke in homicide in Manhattan North. We would say, oh, we can't let the guy know we're looking for him because he'll flee. And everyone was like, yeah, he'll flee to the Bronx.
He'll go to my old precinct.
Which is the next borough over. So I think we could still find him. You know, he's not.
Go over the river, over the East River.
He doesn't have the means to flee to anywhere exotic. Todd Boogs, how many people were bought and paid for by these murderers? Why is this town scared? So much to unpack in this town. Todd Boogs, I am asking that question. I don't have independent knowledge of that, but it seemed from some of the things I've been reading that people in this town are terrified of these people. Michelle Burns, QQQ, is it unusual that they are confessing? Yes and no, Michelle. Sometimes people that do horrific things have a need to confess, believe it or not, and they don't think of the ramifications. Once they meet their attorneys and their attorney tells them how stupid it was that you confessed, then they'll try to recant their confession, and their attorneys will try to have the confession found, you know, not done properly, that she was threatened, that they weren't read Miranda, whatever reason, they'll try to have it squashed. But I think that the Oklahoma State Bureau of Investigation has done an extremely competent job so far. So I don't think that these confessions are going to get thrown out. The love of God. Sergeant Bill and Professor Mike, is it possible Cora's husband is holding against her complainant witness speaking up to law enforcement? You're talking about the Twombleys. Well, that's the 16-year-old daughter. They'll never have any control over that 16-year-old daughter again. When someone is a witness, the police aren't stupid. They know that down the road, the witness can recant, can change their whole story. So it is the statement and the evidence is taken in great detail. And a witness like the complainant witness who she's referred to, the 16-year-old daughter of Cora Twombly, I would get that on video. I would absolutely get it 100% and go over each piece of evidence with her on video and also memorialize it by, you know, I shouldn't say typewriter, that's back in my day, but on the computer, have it typed out, of course, and have all of the evidence and all the things she said recorded so that down the road, she, if someone tries to get to her, she can't recant her statement. Mike.
Yeah, Billy, that's a great thing to do because we know, and you know, anytime you get sort of like, especially in domestic violence, sadly, people start pressuring the victim in to try to drop the charges because maybe you know, the marriage, the families, you know, the breadwinner now is being arrested, you know, that sort of thing. Why would you break up the family? And they'll deny making 911 phone calls. They'll deny making complaints. I've had it happen to me several times as an arresting officer. And, you know, you just shake your head because you're trying your hardest to help a victim of a crime. But yet for emotional reasons and maybe for monetary reasons, a lot of pressure from family and friends, they go back and they renounce their statements. But as any attorney, district attorney will tell you, you know, you have their 911 calls, you have, you know, a statement to the police, especially if it's, as Billy said, it is, you know, taped, videotaped, and it's a signed statement. It's great detail. Yeah, they could always go back and say, no, I was wrong, you know, that sort of thing. But the truth is that everyone in the courtroom, everyone down the line in the future is going to know that they're only saying that because they were under a lot of pressure from someone. And so those statements can absolutely be admissible in court, no matter what that person says on down the line. So you won't lose that, you know, that statement from the complaining witness if for any reason she feels pressure from family members to recant her testimony, her statements to the police. You won't ever lose that. I imagine the OSBI, I imagine they got their act together and they did it, you know, exactly the right way. And so that's good. That's probably the good news about this case.
100%. Sharon Reynolds, sorry I'm having to say goodnight. It's 3 a.m. in the morning in London. Goodbye. Take care, everyone. Have a great show. Sorry I can't stay till the end. Well, Sharon, thank you for staying as long as you did. 3 a.m. in the morning. It's that's admirable to stay with us as long as you did. Let me get back to News Nation. This on the screen is Paul Grice. He's number five. He's the fifth person arrested, charged with two counts of first-degree murder, two counts of kidnapping, and, of course, conspiracy to commit murder. And he apparently gave a very, very much detailed confession. And we'll, after we play this, we'll go into the why.
We were out in that area where the bodies were buried 10 feet down. It's an area that Paul Grice knows well. Everybody knows each other in that area. And again, the land that he rents where he lives with his family is very, very close to that spot.
Doesn't get more clear than that. Planning, murder, and burial, police say he's confessing to. It just makes me wonder, is he desperate to give them everything on the other four to try to save his head? This is a death penalty state. And so if he's got a good lawyer, the lawyer will say, run to the well first and maybe you'll get a good drink and the rest of them will go thirsty. So the other detail that you learned today, you know, as we learn these things, a lot of times there's some shifting in details. We had a source early on that said it looked like they'd been shot. The two women had been shot outside the car. The medical examiner throws water on all of that.
Yeah, this is something that I've been trying to nail down for the last couple of days. I heard, I got a tip about it and was trying to get it confirmed by the medical examiner, and we finally did. The medical examiner in Oklahoma has confirmed that the two victims that you see right there, Veronica and Jillian, were not shot. So they were not shot, no gunshot wounds. This was not a shooting. What the actual cause of death was, we don't know. They're not revealing that yet. But, you know, it's more barbaric than I think that we realized. This could possibly be an explanation. You remember, they didn't positively identify the bodies for a couple of days. It took them a couple of days. And this may be a reason why. It may have really just been a very brutal killing, Ashley.
It's so upsetting to, I mean, there's nothing that can make you feel better about this story, but for the fact that you hope that they died quickly and painlessly, and maybe it was a bullet they didn't even see coming. But given these details that there was a broken hammer found with the glasses behind the vehicle, and that they weren't shot, it just makes you wonder, were they beaten to death? Did they use a hammer? Were they strangled? I mean, it could not, and there were two of them, and apparently potentially five with stun guns, keeping them, you know. It's just an awful, awful series. Last thing real quickly, why was he released? Why was Paul Grice brought in and released and then grabbed again after the other four? It's a big mystery.
Yeah, it's a very, very good question, and we don't know the answer. Again, he was not brought in. He didn't go in on his own the first time. He was brought in almost like he was going to be arrested. They did the interviews.
You know, when you see this group, here you now have all five of them together in this little rogues gallery, this little lineup you see on the screen. Tiffany Adams, Tadbert Cullum, Paul Earl Twombly, Cora Twombly, and Paul Grice. And the catalyst, the person behind this whole thing, is Tiffany Adams on the left, the grandmother. And then you question why Tad Burt Cullum, of course, is of what we learned her significant other, her boyfriend. But what made the other four, besides Tiffany, commit this horrific crime? And that is sort of our whole dissertation for this show, is was it this organization, this God's misfits? Is that what gave them loyalty to each other and to do this almost military planning of a murder that took place over several weeks, several months, and then to execute this plan, obviously a premeditated plan? Something is not right. Something is rotten in Denmark, as they say. And I think that what we may see, and I'm now more and more convinced of it, we may see more arrests in this, Mike.
Yeah, Billy, you know, when you see this horrific killing of two beautiful young ladies, and it looks like they may have been beaten to death, and you're looking at, you know, who's got the emotional interest in doing this sort of thing, and to get the Twombleys and Grice involved, maybe, and I said a little bit about this earlier, maybe they did, you know, Grice and the Twombleys did, Tiffany and her boyfriend, maybe they were returning a favor for something that maybe Tiffany had done for someone that Grice or the Twombleys did not want around maybe 6 months ago or a year ago. Because to be talked into, or maybe your arm wasn't twisted, but being maybe there was no pressure, but actually just engaging in this planning over the course of a while, you know, you'd got to think that Grice and the Twombleys had a lot of time to think about what they were doing and whether or not they want to get involved in this, get involved in Tiffany's affairs, in Tiffany's, you know, family. So I'm thinking there may be something else out there that may have been done in the past. This is payback because maybe they were helped out before. And remember, as a group, you know, there's groupthink. And I don't know if they did, but if they have gotten away with something before as a group, and now it's time to do another kind of criminal act, in this case, murder, and they got away with the first, if that was the case, they're more likely to say, okay, we got away with it once. Now we're going to do something else as a group. Groupthink sets in, you know, and they may feel as sovereign citizens that they may have the ability to thwart law enforcement. You know, that's a very rural area out there. I'm sure the sheriff's office is probably understaffed, and I'm sure there's not a lot of investigators and a big budget and not a lot of personnel. So I'm thinking that this may not be the first homicide that this group may have engaged in, and therefore having maybe perhaps successfully done other criminal activity in the past, a feeling of maybe invincibility a little bit. And so therefore it's time now to kill someone else. It may sound weird, but I'm kind of like leaning that way, thinking about the group dynamics.
Mike, I think you're right. Let me go to the chat. Malibu Surfer. Grice looked like he had such a nice family. You're right. He had three kids. What's he thinking of now? His kids don't have a father because he's going to prison for the rest of his life, or he could get the death penalty. Exactly. What the hell was he thinking about? Annie Oakley from the chat, 777. Tiffany probably paid them all off. People were scared of her. She was a powerful woman who was used to getting her way. Wow. Mother, just for fun, take five. What is anti-American in the 21st century? There's lots of ways you can be anti-American. One of them is to be a sovereign citizen and not follow the laws and act as if you're above the law or the law doesn't apply to you. Miss Chris, so awful how these folks just felt they could take her life away, both of their lives. You know, Miss Chris, not only did they take the lives of these two women, they basically took their own lives because their lives are over now, as they knew it. You know, their lives either what they have to look forward to is either the death penalty or life in prison without parole. That's what they have to look forward to. So in doing this, I don't know if they thought they were going to get away with it. I guess everyone that commits a murder must think they're going to get away with it. There's no other explanation from it. You know, why would they do it unless they thought they could get away with it? The ugly truckling influenced them to do it by accusing the mother of child abuse in the manner. So everybody wanted to play heroes at police off the cuff. Yeah, well, you know, the ugly trucking, that's a possibility. I hadn't thought of that. But that also, that allegation can just be an allegation without any fact. We don't know. Casaria, I think they're all a bunch of meth addicts. Meth makes people arrogant, way overconfident, and kills their conscience. Kills the all drugs, makes you lose your soul, that's for sure. Let me go back to Banfield here.
And then they released him. What they've learned between then and now, we don't know. I will say I've been talking to locals on the ground there. Not totally shocked, obviously, by this arrest since he was in the affidavit to begin with, but a lot of sadness because he's got three kids too. Now they've got to sort all of that out. So the whole community is still very much torn apart over all this.
Thank you for watching.
So, someone in the chat also just said, and this is sort of a horrific thing to think about, but righteous by faith. One expert pretty much said that tasers were used to disable and then the hammer was used to murder. That, you know, something I was obviously thinking the same thing. I almost didn't want to say it, but that very well could be the way they were killed. And that's a horrific death if that was the case. To Boogs, it was brazen. People knew the ladies were going, knew who they were going to meet. They did it anyway. Forensic psychologists will be unpacking this for decades. Yeah, I mean, and I think that the from what we're saying right now, what we see and our instincts as cops, this investigation is not over. There may be some more people getting arrested here. Exeter Line 1930, I wonder how many people in their God's Misfits Club, how many attended the weekly meetings? That's your guess is as good as mine. I don't know. And your thoughts, Mike, about that?
Billy, you know, that's a great question. And I would think if I'm an Oklahoma State Bureau of Investigations officer, I'm going to go and talk to that complaining witness, the Twombly's daughter, because she seemed to have seen and heard a lot about what went on. And I would imagine that if they would talk to her as calmly as they did after they had killed these two beautiful ladies and then talked about, you know, cleaning the Chevrolet, cleaning the pickup truck, I would imagine there was a lot of candid, offhanded remarks, and that the complaining witness, the 16-year-old, may have a treasure trove of information in terms of all the other people that may have been mentioned in the past. So I think this case may be a springboard for the Oklahoma State Bureau of Investigation and maybe the FBI working hand in hand, get another agent out there and start some sort of other offshoot investigation. Yeah, I think so. Absolutely. These five people may be just the tip of the iceberg. There may be a lot more people that they're associated with, either loosely or closely, that this girl, 16-year-old, may know about. And, you know, every time you get a name, you get an ID, and then you get lead to another name and another name and another name. But, I think the same way. This is going to be a lot more coming after this.
Absolutely. Aunt BB2, Sergeant Bill, Professor Geary, when Granny attempted this in February, was she alone or were all these sickos in on that plan? I believe they were all in on the plan in February, too.
I think so.
Because that's what was told to us by complainant witness, 16 years old, who is Cora Twombly's daughter. So I think these plans and these meetings have been going on for a while. That's why I'm concerned that this God's Misfits group here planned some nefarious things, and this wasn't their first rodeo, as they say.
Right.
You know, I want to play also, this is where a little bit about Paul Grice's admitting to what he did.
Tiffany, the confession reads, according to the affidavit, Grice was interviewed and admitted that he was a part of the planning and killing of both Butler and Kelly. Grice admitted that he participated in the killing of Butler and Kelly and their subsequent burial. So they are saying that not only was he connected to the planning, to the actual killing, but then also the burial. And you remember, we were out in that area where the bodies were buried 10 feet down. It's an area that Paul Grice knows well. Everybody knows each other in that area. And again, the land that he rents, where he lives with his family, is very, very close to that spot.
Doesn't get more clear than that. Planning, murder, and burial, police say he's confessing to. It just makes me wonder, is he desperate to give them everything on the other four to try to save his head? This is a death penalty state. And so if he's got a good lawyer, the lawyer will say, run to the well first and maybe you'll get a good drink, and the rest of them will go thirsty. So the other detail that you learned today, you know, as we learn these things, a lot of times there's some shifting in details. We had a source early on that said it looked like they'd been shot. The two women had been shot outside the car. The medical examiner throws water on all of that.
Yeah, this is something that I've been trying to nail.
So we went over this already. I just wanted to show you the confession that Paul Grice made, but we went over it before that this apparently was a potentially a blunt trauma death, not a gunshot.
You know, it's more barbaric than I think that we realized. This could possibly be an explanation. You remember, they didn't positively identify the bodies for a couple of days. It took them a couple of days. And this may be a reason why. It may have really just been a very brutal killing, Ashley.
It's so upsetting. I mean, there's nothing that can make you feel better about this story, but for the fact that you hope that they died quickly and painlessly, and maybe it was a bullet they didn't even see coming. But given these details, that there was a broken hammer found with the glasses behind the vehicle, and that they weren't shot, it just makes you wonder, were they beaten to death? Did they use a hammer? Were they strangled? I mean, it could not, and there were two of them, and apparently potentially five with stun guns, keeping them, you know. It's just an awful, awful series. Last thing real quickly, why was he released? Why was Paul Grice brought in and released and then grabbed again after the other four? It's a big mystery.
Yeah, it's a very, very good question, and we don't know the answer. Again, he was not brought in. He didn't go in on his own the first time. He was brought in almost like he was going to be arrested. They did the interviews, and then they released him. What they've learned between then and now, we don't know. I will say I've been talking to locals on the ground there. Not totally shocked, obviously, by this arrest, since he was in the affidavit to begin with, but a lot of sadness because he's got three kids, too. And you know that, you know, now they've got to sort all of that out. So the whole community is still very much torn apart over all this.
You know, Mike, how do you give up your life by doing something like this? You know, here's Paul Grice, he's in his early 30s, got a family, three kids, and what made his brain do something so stupid with these other four people? And, you know, besides the brutality of murdering somebody, which is horrific, he had to know that he was destroying his own life by getting it. And did the anti-government group God's Misfits facilitate the murders of the Kansas moms? That's the question we wanted to ask right from the very beginning. And apparently, from what we're learning, the answer is yes, yes. Mike.
Yeah, Billy, you know, you just got to figure what would make a person, you know, engage in this sort of very dangerous conduct. You know, you got to say, is it loyalty to some group? Is it peer pressure? Is it religious fervor? Is it you owe someone a debt and you're trying to repay it? You know, why would you risk your life for the rest of your life engaging this? Maybe you've done it before and you got away with it, so you feel a little bit immune. Maybe the idea that you are a sovereign citizen, and he did write a diatribe about how he and he alone owns himself and his children, and the government cannot have any control over his life. Maybe that feeling that, you know, you've got Kelly and Butler coming and the mother wants to eliminate one of them and the other one just happens to be there representing, remember, that child custody order and that allow the mother to have the grandmother to have custody, that comes from a government and agency, a court, a judge, and yet they want to be sovereign. So when it fits them, they're happy with it. But perhaps when it doesn't, and the idea that the children are going to be allowed to see their mother, and there's already a court date, just in case for maybe modification of this court order, that's a government agency again stepping in. So perhaps a little animosity towards the government for actually trying to control an aspect of their of his friends, meaning the Adams's life. So it could be a multifaceted reason to do what he did. To us, it sounds a little bizarre, crazy, idiotic, because you're a father, you have children. Why would you ever do something like that? But from his perspective, where he's coming from in his life and what he sees as loyalty and do-gooding and helping your friends out of some sort of a legal jam by killing someone, for them, it seems to make sense. As crazy it is, it seems to make sense from their point of view. We might not understand it. We might not hold those values, but you've talked to many murderers, and you and Phil, and sometimes the answers they give you as to why they would kill somebody seems rather petty, bizarre, idiotic, stupid, bullheaded, moronic, but they did it anyway. Right. And they did it because it made sense to them.
At the time they did it, yeah.
Right, at the time they did it.
Miss Chris, I have dealt with sovereign citizens at the jail before years ago, and they really do believe they rule themselves and no one else does.
Mm-hmm.
It's sort of an arrogant thing that, oh, yes, you're going to live in a free country and you're going to, when you're challenged by the law, you're going to tell them that you don't apply, the laws don't apply to you because you're a sovereign citizen.
Right.
I mean, I never met any sovereign citizens in my police career, but I watched some of these videos online, and when they act as if the police aren't going to enforce the laws on them because they've declared, it's even more funny to watch them in court when the judge just throws them in jail. It's like, it's unbelievable. I want to say something also about this area of Oklahoma. In no way are we trying to disparage this area of Oklahoma and Texas and Kansas. This is God's country, middle America, you know, and we appreciate you guys. But a couple of people even in the chat said, why don't you cover crime in New York City? Well, they had a case like this that was a national story like this, I would cover it. But this happens to be the case that has gotten sort of everyone's attention here, you know. Because Casarija, not to beat a dead horse, but meth also makes people exceedingly stupid and irrational. They thought they could get away with it. Meth is absolutely rampant in rural areas of Oklahoma. I think it's rampant everywhere, you know. Dane Crawford from the chat, if they don't do it, they might have to watch their back. This is almost as a gang thing. New York Mike, I think I don't get of the own thousands of acres and equipment. How can they all ask for a public defender? Well, you can ask. You don't always get one. They do a background. They do a financial on you to see if you're eligible for a public defender. Exeter Line 1930, Grice had that quasi-legal statement about his beliefs. It seems somewhat structured, kind of like a formal compact of the misfits, like the Pilgrims. Ha ha. Yeah, I mean, a lot of these groups that have almost like what you would call a manifesto. That's what it boils down. Chuka Girl 1, It would be nice if all of you out here reading these crimes would band together to shine a light on all this darkness. God bless all of us fighting this ugliness. Well, there is Chuka Girl. There is ugliness in this world, and we are trying to shine a light on it. Juanita Lewis, I think Wrangler Rickman knew that his mom, Granny, had something planned. How long was Wrangler in rehab before the woman's death? Wrangler had custody, which was another bizarre thing. He had custody, and he sort of had a bombastic relationship with Tiffany also. Pim, maybe Granny threatened the other people. Maybe she threatened Grice's family in some way if he did not do this. She seemed to have the power over people. That's what we're trying to find out, Pim. We're trying to find out if she did have that power over people.
It was to drop it right through the windshield, right through Veronica's windshield and kill her that way. So we learned all of that over the weekend, which shows why, again, why people were so nervous. They knew what these four suspects were capable of.
All of these allegations until they're proven in court, but I do go back to this quote. They have a history of violent interactions, including death threats and intimidation against individuals who disagree with their ideas. They abide by their own philosophy and have no regard for the sanctity of human life. Those are not our words. They were the whisper words, and now they're the words of the DA against Tiffany and Tad. Okay, let's talk about this business of a confession. Everybody is saying confession, but we're kind of toiling through those words, and I'm retooling whether I think it's a confession or not. There are recordings that the authorities got of Tiffany Adams shortly after her arrest, Brian, where she indicated that she was responsible for these deaths. So I want to get your read on that and your feel for whether you think that's a confession or whether you think it just might be she said something so off base and such, was so dumb and didn't think it through, that it was clear she was involved.
I mean, it sounds like a confession to me, actually. I had to read it three times when it came in on Saturday because I'm like, wait, what does this say? It was a little confusing. I'll read it to you again. Tiffany Adams did provide a recorded statement to law enforcement indicating her responsibility for the deaths of the deceased. Certainly sounds like a confession. The first thing I thought of was, I mean, man, she doesn't even have an attorney yet, because that was clear at the hearing, and she's already talking to police in a recorded state.
You know, why does the press not understand that once a person has an attorney, they're not going to speak to the police? They just don't get it. And folks, what I'll explain to you is that when someone is in custody under arrest, the police want to get a statement from that person. What they must do is not call the person's attorney, then there will be no statement. What they will do is they will read Miranda warnings and get the person to waive their rights of a person in custody. Once that is accomplished, they then can interview the person and get an admission, a confession, whatever the person's offering up. But the press is always saying, oh, how did she do that without an attorney? Why don't you understand? Because once an attorney is involved, there will be absolutely no statement. So I just wanted to point that out, because it's not just Brian Enten, who's an excellent reporter. It's the press collectively. Don't understand this. Schmitty, thank you for the $5 super sticker. I struggle with and dislike the term sovereign citizen when it comes to these people. It's like we give them credit somehow. It's sort of a new term, but we see it more and more out there, people claiming this, and I don't know where they get it from either. Like, I'm a sovereign citizen. Like, where did you get that from? You know, how do you think that you're going to tell that to a cop that pulls you over for speeding, and you could say, I'm a sovereign citizen, I don't abide by the laws of this county, this state, or this country? You know, I would say, okay, step out of the car, please. When you're back, you're under arrest, you know. But they fight it right till the end, you know. Sometimes they have to have their windows broken to pull them out, forcibly remove them from the car. And that's where sometimes the sovereign citizen realizes windows are expensive. Maybe he won't be sovereign the next time, you know. Let me go back to Brian Enten here.
Statement. You know, Oklahoma is a death penalty state. is it possible? I mean, she's, you know, she's slick. Is it possible that she's trying to outsmart the others and start talking immediately, get on investigators' good side, start cooperating? Maybe she avoids the death penalty and, you know, can cooperate. That's kind of the first thing I thought of.
Or she pulls the old, you know, they did it. And I got bullied or beaten right into going along with it. I mean, there's all sorts of different permutations and combinations for how to be first to the well if there's four of you going, you know, to trial for double murder in a death penalty state. So the other thing was that she did enter a not guilty plea. So that's in contravention to this whole notion that she admitted it to investigators. And then the other reporting that we have, which is not part of the affidavit, this is source reporting here at News Nation, and that is that she did not provide the accurate location of the gravesite. You've been there. You literally were there. It's not hard to miss. What do you make of the fact that she didn't provide accurate information to the gravesite, to the investigators?
I mean, is it possible she wasn't there? And back to the not guilty plea, I mean, I think that that's almost like a formality. They all just entered not guilty sure pleas immediately. So I don't know that that really means, well, then why did she confess and how do those two things relate to each other? I think she didn't have a lawyer yet and she just automatically entered the not guilty plea. In terms of where the bodies were discovered and whether she led them to the wrong spot or gave bad information, you know, I don't really know what to make of it. You know, what I've heard from the beginning is that it was the burner phone, cell phone pings that led police to that area and to start digging in that area. And if you live in that area, and I learned this talking to the ranchers out there, if you live out there, you know what the soil is supposed to look like. You know the color it's supposed to be. You know the consistency it's supposed to be. You know exactly the way it's supposed to feel under your feet. And they were able to figure out relatively quickly in that area that there had been some digging in that spot. They tried to cover with the hay, which I know you're going to get into later. But I think the cell phone pings are what brought them
there. You're going to show us. Definitely they did. So I keep coming back to, well, what did Tiffany say? Where did she send them? If she was giving information about where the bodies could be found, but it wasn't accurate, it doesn't make sense because they probably knew already from, I think, Jamie Beasley is the landowner, right? He rented land. He leased land to Tad. And then Tad came.
You know, Mike, I think there's no doubt that the cell phones led them right to that spot. I don't think they needed Granny's directions, Granny, to tell them that. And of course, Granny's Tiffany Adams. I think the cell phone pings, the geofencing led them right to the location. And of course, Beasley leased the land to Tad Cullum. So it was almost like a no-brainer that was part of it. The cell phone pings, the fact that they found out Beasley leased this land to Tad Cullum, that allowed them to understand where the land was. Trucker Girl, thank you for the $9.99 super sticker. Thank you for covering this with no sugarcoating. Well, we try to give it to you from a police perspective, and thank you for your contribution. Very much appreciated. So I don't think that, you know, probably Granny didn't give a full confession, although I spoke about it. Let me just play this, and then I'll speak a little more to the confessions.
Came to him and said, I'm going to do some digging down by the dam. No big thing. I'm just moving a tree stump. Well, it turned out that was not what they were doing. They were digging allegedly a 10-foot grave. And that's how, you know, the authorities know that not only was Tad there for that meeting prior to digging, but so was Tiffany. Tiffany, according to the authorities, was there for that meeting beforehand saying, I'm bringing a front end loader on, a skidder or whatever they call it, and we're going to dig and we're going to move some land and it's all good by you. Thanks. Okay. All good. Let's go. So Tiffany was there. She knew exactly what it was they were doing, according to the authorities. So if she sent them to a different location, I think they had her right there by the, you know, they had her tight because they already knew from Mr. Beasley that.
And that could explain how they got the statement that we've been trying to figure out. You know, is it a confession? Is it not a confession? Yeah. I guess that could relate back to that.
Could have. Can you just touch real quickly on the soil? Because there was a detail. There was a detail on how they finished off the grave that would make it look normal. What was that detail involving the cows?
You're talking about the hay, right? Yeah. So what they did, according to the sources when we were in the area, is And again, these are people who know how to dig, who know how to farm, who have equipment. That's why they were able to get 10 feet down, which is unheard of. And once they covered the area back up with all of the dirt, they knew to go get hay and spread hay over that entire area because there are cows that graze there. And they knew by spreading the hay there, the cows would move into that specific spot. They would start stomping around, they would start eating, and they would make it less noticeable that the soil had been disturbed there from all of the digging.
Thank you for
Brilliant, because that is how the police, that is how they would look for a potential grave site from the air, you know, helicopters, drones, they could find it to see that land that was disturbed. And helicopters have these infrared cameras that can spot things like that. So it is quite amazing. Nap Connoisseur, thank you so much for the $10 super sticker. My first Police Off the Cuff Live. Enjoy the insight, perspectives, and no-nonsense discussions of you and all your amazing guests. Thank you. Nap Connoisseur, thank you. Very much appreciated. I hope you're subscribed. I think I recognize you, but I hope you're subscribed. Thank you so much. You know, one of the things, I did a whole show on confessions, and detectives, when they take a confession, they take an admission. The first thing they have to get through, of course, is Miranda warnings. They have to get the person to waive Miranda. And that's done by the detective reading all five warnings and having the person being interviewed sign off, sign next to them that they understand, and then actually sign a waiver, a physical waiver. Then the interview can proceed. And a detective is not just going to let someone go off on a tangent and talk. They're going to ask them very specific questions. And then in a case like this, an interview could take 6, 8, 10 hours and could be 8 to 10 pages long. So I don't know if they got that much of a detailed confession from Granny, because maybe she didn't have the concentration to give that level of an interview, that level of a confession. But for sure, she confessed. However that confession looks, whether it's enough or not, we don't know. By Blues Shopper, thank you for the $5 super sticker. Love this coverage. Well, thank you very much. We're very flattered that you guys love us from a police perspective, police off the cuff. Mike, your thoughts about the confession and confessions now, because Paul Grice confessed also.
Right. Yeah. People don't realize that even though the police want to question someone who's in custody and they want to interrogate them with a series of, you know, questions, and they warn them, you know, the right to remain silent, anything you say can only be used against you in court of law. You have a right to an attorney. If you can't afford one, won't be appointed. You know, like everybody knows them. The police actually, before they want to talk to the suspect, they have to actually tell the suspect, you know, you don't have to talk to us. You can actually have an attorney if you want. And strangely, as much as it seems a little strange, statistically about 75 to 80% of criminal suspects voluntarily waive the right to an attorney, waive the right to not say anything under Miranda, and start talking. And for law enforcement, that's excellent, because once you have been given Miranda and you waive your right to have an attorney and not to say anything, anything and everything that you say is considered voluntary. And we believe that voluntary admissions by suspects are accurate. And also, once the police officer or the detective takes the statement, after, like you said, after many hours, someone is going to go out and start to verify the points made by the interviewee, by the suspect, to corroborate what was said in the statement. And if you can corroborate what's in the statement, then you know absolutely it is 100% ironclad accurate. And that's really important. And any suspect with an attorney who gets the attorney later on after the arraignment in court, after the initial appearance, the attorney will always try to knock that out, say they violated Miranda. They try it all the time, but because of the statement that they sign, and it's dated, and especially if you have it on video, it is very often, they are very often unsuccessful in trying to knock that statement out. And that statement will come in to hurt that suspect's, criminal interests, and it will be admissible at trial. So I know Brian Hinton, and you say the press, they're like amazed that these statements are given, but statistically it's 75 to 80% of the suspects actually do waive their rights and talk to the police. So it's not uncommon whatsoever. It's actually very common.
You know, Mike, I also wanted to say, and a professional detective will do this also. First of all, it's very smart for any jurisdiction to videotape it. Mm-hmm. This way, a defense attorney can't say, oh, my client was beaten. My client had welts all over. You know, you could see the person. The other thing is during these interviews, it's always smart for the investigator to offer water, bathroom breaks, and food, and document such in the report. Because what is the first thing a defense attorney? My client didn't eat. My client didn't drink. My client wasn't allowed to use the bathroom. She was treated like an animal.
Yeah.
The detective has all of these things documented. The attorney can't go there. He or she can go there, but the prosecutor can say, counselor, the detective offered her a bathroom break every half hour, and she was offered food, and she was also offered to take a break at certain intervals. So she was treated humanely. That's important.
Billy, it's important for the investigation. It's important for the investigator. It's important for the public to know that that's how this is done today. This isn't like some old time movie from the 1930s with Jimmy Cagney, gangster movies. No, where they're, the third degree treatment. No, I encourage people to watch shows like The First 48 Hours on TV, things like that. And you actually see the way things are done professionally because you see it in real life. There's plenty of these confessions on TV, court TV and things like that. And that's the way they go. They're very, very calm. And they are done over and over and over and over again the same way. And people are treated, to bathroom breaks. And like you say, because a detective does not want to mistreat a suspect, because if you mistreat the suspect, they'll shut up and not say anything. They'll get mad at you. So you treat them as kindly as you can. And this way they'll respond, you hope, positively, and talk and give you information to help with the investigation. You catch more flies with honey. Policing is so much more professional than it was, from you see in old movies. It's done really well, and it's done very professionally, and it should make the public actually feel confident that the statements are accurate and that justice will have been served.
100%. Susan Rome, Rickman's grandmother, Debbie Knox Davis, stated that Rickman told her that they didn't have to worry about the custody battle much longer because Adams had it under control, so he knew about it. And Rickman is, of course, Tiffany Adams' son and the father of the children involved in this custody battle. Well, Susan, I think you're right, and is there a possibility that Rickman is involved in this too, or knew about this? Yeah, I think there is. I mean, we're not pointing fingers, but I wouldn't be surprised. Sherry, why a 10-foot grave? They had probably a back hole that they were digging with, and they just decided, I'm sure if they were digging it by hand, it wouldn't be 10 feet, but they had machines there to dig it, so they dug it extra deep, Dragonfly Lady, and I don't believe for a minute that law enforcement isn't aware of this cult, the Misfits, and were aware of the custody issues and the threats being made. They did nothing. Dragonfly Lady, I don't doubt you. I'm just saying that I know that they had interviewed some FBI agents and they hadn't heard of specifically God's misfits. Lotus, they were dumb and left the car there. If they hit the car good and got rid of the hammer, you know, Lotus, you're right. That was a glaring mistake that they, I mean, if you're thinking like a murderer and thinking like you want to get away with it, to leave the car there.
That's right.
Trucker Girl, thank you for the $9.99 super sticker. Thank you, Professor Michael Geary, for predicting at acting this overview. Predicting. I'm missing a word there. But yeah, we all appreciate Professor Mike Geary, and thank you so much, Trucker Girl. We appreciate it. So we're expecting in this case, I'm expecting there to be some more arrests. I really am. And our whole dissertation here, again, using that word, it's probably beyond my pay grade to use such a big word. But did the anti-government group, God's Misfits, facilitate the murders of the Kansas City moms? And I think the answer is yes. And it was well planned. They met for weeks. And it's horrific when you think about it, when you think about these two women that lost their lives here, Veronica Butler and Jillian Kelly, and the planning and the people whose lives have now been ruined. And not talking about these people. They get will receive what they actually deserve. Tiffany Adams, Cole Twombly, Tad Cullum, and Cora Twombly. And now add number five, Paul Grice, to this. I'm sure they will all get their deserved penalty. Let me play a little bit of this.
Women, Veronica Butler and Jillian Kelly.
You're talking about Northern Texas County near that Kansas line. It's very rural.
Take a look for yourself. It was right here at Road L and Highway 95 where Butler and Kelly's car was found. This affidavit revealing there was blood on the roadway, a broken hammer, and even a pistol magazine inside Kelly's purse. An affidavit from the Texas County Clerk shows evidence of a custody battle between Veronica Butler and Tiffany Adams, the grandmother of Butler's two children. On March 30th, Butler was set to meet Adams and her two children in rural Texas County, Oklahoma, for a visit. Jillian Kelly was also there as a court-ordered supervisor.
There's not a lot of homes, not a lot of buildings or businesses. Sometimes you could use cameras to help you in this case. We did not have that. So that's what made it extremely challenging.
The investigation was stalled until an interview with the 16-year-old daughter of Cole and Cora Twombly, the two other suspects. In the affidavit, she's referred to as CW. CW recounts the chilling moments her parents came home 2 hours after the crime. They told her to clean their truck and that she no longer had to worry about Veronica Butler.
We used that to search a wide area throughout Texas County, and we were able to use those resources in order to find where these two bodies were.
CW later telling investigators there was an attempt to kill Veronica Butler months prior in February of 2024. That attempt was unsuccessful because Butler refused to leave her house. That evidence, along with cell phone records placing Adams and Trombley's phones near the scene, led to the arrest of the suspects.
You can't give away as much as maybe you guys are asking for, because that's how we're able to catch these four suspects.
As the investigation continues, the cause of death for Butler and Kelly still hasn't been determined. Questions still unanswered as two families begin the grieving process.
This case was tragic. You have two people who are dead, and four people that committed an absolutely brutal crime.
Max Dutton, 12 News.
And those four suspects made a first appearance in court on Wednesday, just days after the bodies of the two women were discovered. Backbone reporter Jacob Albrock has the details from that court appearance.
So we know this was earlier in the case. Right. Julia Ann, police off the cuff. Granny's meth fed monsters. Granny's the drug queen pin in them parts. Thank you, Sergeant Bill and Professor Mike. Well,
you're welcome.
You know, when we first saw her picture, right away, drugs came to mind. And her earliest arrest photo, There you have it there. I mean, that's not a good look. I don't think she wants to be on the cover of Vogue with that picture. But it does scream drug abuse in that picture. And potentially are the other people involved here being controlled by drugs in some way? You know, we'll find all of this stuff out down the road. But for right now, we don't know that. We don't know for sure. But what we do know is we think that God's misfits did facilitate these murders of the Kansas moms. They planned it. They pulled it off. They planned to do it in February, and it was unsuccessful. So there's no doubt that they planned these murders and saw it through. Mike, your final thoughts.
Final thoughts. I think that people should be very confident in the investigation done by the OSBI, the Texas County Sheriffs, even the Kansas patrol on their side of the border, and the FBI. You know, they are professional organizations. They did a great job. We should just pray for the Butler and Kelly families, keep them in our prayers, and for their families and their children too, because everyone loses in this case. And these young ladies met a horrific and violent end that is totally unbelievable and inexcusable. And so we should just keep them in our prayers.
100%. And we always at this point point out to the victims, Veronica Butler, Jillian Kelly, may they rest in peace. God bless their families, their children, and their loved ones. And as we said, the police so far have done an outstanding job. Let's hope they see this whole case through its fruition and everyone involved in it gets justice. Folks, thank you so much for tuning in tonight. I'm Bill Cannon from Police Off the Cuff Real Crime Stories. Have a great night, everyone, and God bless.
Good night.